I'm very pleased to be welcoming Akhil Bilgrami today. Akhil is the Sidney Morgan Besser Professor of Philosophy at Columbia University, where he also holds an appointment in the Committee on Global Thought and directs the Southern Asian Institute. At Columbia, he also served as director of the Hyman Center for the Humanities from 2004 to 2011, and as chair of the Philosophy Department from 1995 to 1999. He's held visiting professorships at many universities here and abroad, and has received numerous awards, fellowships, and grants. Akhil works across two broad and typically rather separate scholarly areas, philosophy of language and mind, and philosophy, politics, and culture. He's published two books in the area of philosophy of mind, Belief and Meaning, 1992, and Self-Knowledge and Resentment, 2012, and over 80 articles and essays spanning both his broad areas of expertise, which have appeared in a number of important venues. I refer you especially to his many publications in critical inquiry over the years, to his postings on the influential website, The Immanent Frame, and his essays in wider circulation periodicals such as the New York Review of Books. I will focus my introduction today on Akhil's work in the field of politics and culture. Given the range of important topics he has addressed, I will restrict myself to isolating what I take to be some of the central contributions of his writings over the past decade or so. First, Akhil's writings have worked to complicate and illuminate our understanding of identity and belief, two key terms in recent political and cultural theory. Akhil helpfully situates his discussion of identity by taking the distinction between first-person and third-person perspectives as a starting point, which is to say he insists from the start that it makes a world of difference whether one takes oneself to hold an identity, and further, whether that identity is intensely held and connected to political aims, or by contrast, whether an identity is imposed upon one or considered as a primary, salient, objective fact about one, regardless of one's own views about its relevance or importance. Throughout his work, Akhil privileges the agency-suffused, self-authorizing first-person perspective over the third-person or external perspective, though without denying practical, analytic, and historical relevance to the latter. This privileging will be important to his attempts to move beyond disabling analyses of various forms of political or social psychology, including especially accounts of whole swaths of the public as acting against their own interests, as in popular accounts of non-wealthy conservative Republicans, for example, or in theories of false consciousness, which have had many afterlives since Marx. In place of such approaches, Akhil brings a nuanced account of moral psychology to bear on some of the more tense and volatile political issues surrounding identity in our time. While identities can be and are used for political purposes, to mobilize around a given goal, such as national independence or gender justice, they also register complex political histories and serve important psychological roles as a source of dignity and self-respect, solidarity and belonging, etc. In a number of important articles, Akhil has intervened productively in debates over Islam, and in particular over the question of moderate versus absolutist Islam, to argue that there are psychological reasons, grounded in the history of colonialism and the complex geopolitics of the Cold War, of Israel-Palestine, and of the War on Terror, why moderate Muslims who oppose absolutist Islam are nonetheless unlikely to speak out against absolutist acts and actors. Akhil argues that such Muslims are torn between their dislike of absolutist visions and deep defensive feelings of resentment against Western colonial history and its aftermath and continuance via other means. We need a more flexible way, Akhil suggests, to account for the various divided or multiple frames through which individuals filter experience and respond to events. Such a mode of analysis can also be brought to bear on the deeply conservative religiosity of the American heartland, which Akhil argues should be seen not as a form of moral weakness or false consciousness, but as a complex expression of basic yearnings for enchantment, as well as epistemic weakness or deficits brought about by the operations of media in the culture more broadly. The second major avenue pursued by Akhil's work surrounds secularism and enlightenment. In this arena, Akhil is doing something very important and also distinctive. He's making an argument for secularism as a political doctrine, while also arguing for a conception of radical enlightenment that acknowledges enchantment, or a values-suffused world. In his argument for secularism, Akhil extends his emphasis on internal reasons for commitment and belief to the political project of building a secular polity. The result is an argument for something like a Rawlsian overlapping consensus, though without the contractarian apparatus. Central to Akhil's vision here is the importance of engagement and dialogue, with an aim to uncover compatible internal reasons across difference, as well as an insistence that history is open-ended and that beliefs and commitments can and do change over time. The work on radical enlightenment, which interestingly deepens or reinflects the work on secularism, uncovers radical enlightenment as a persistent strand in cultural and political history, stemming from the early modern period through Romanticism and beyond, one which envisions an entirely transformed relation both to nature and to political life, which seeks to promote a being at home in the world, or alternately put, a secular enchantment of the world, and which includes figures as disparate as Spinoza, the English Protestant reformer Gerard Winstanley, William Blake, and Gandhi. Radical enlightenment counters or dissents from the disenchantment of the world associated with the Enlightenment proper, which is associated with predatory commercial attitudes towards nature, modern scientific rationality in the service of capitalism and colonialism, the world-impoverishing effects of disenchantment and alienation, and a limited model of democratic politics. Akhil's influential work on these topics, already available in many long, substantial, utterly compelling articles, will be published in the coming year in the form of three books: Politics and the Moral Psychology of Identity, forthcoming from Harvard; What is a Muslim, forthcoming from Princeton; and Gandhi's Integrity, forthcoming from Columbia. Please join me in welcoming Akhil Bilgrami to SCT.
Well, Amanda, thanks for that generous and accurate it's great to be back at Cornell. Thank you for asking me. Edward Said's most celebrated work is known for its exposure of the distortions in the West's, now usually called the North's, understanding of distant lands that were once called the Orient and are now often called the South. A distortion that comes from refusing to acknowledge the privilege of the metropolitan location from which that understanding is articulated, a privilege derived not from intrinsic qualitative sources, but rather by the brute as well as the commercial force of imperial conquest and its accompanying posture of cultural superiority. This broad exposure was extended by him to the distortions of the self-understanding in those distant lands induced by the cognitive enslavement of the colonized mind and its acquired mimicry of its masters. This utterly familiar critique now of what the cultures and ideas of the South look like from the perspective of the metropolitan North made it possible for others to ask a question that even the long histories of resistance that led to decolonization were not, just by themselves, able to give one the confidence to ask. The question, what do the ideas of the metropole look like from the perspective of the South? Not the metropole's ideas of the Orient or the South, but just simply the ideas of the metropole in its own evolving self-understanding. How do these appear from the perspective of the South? And not how do these appear from the perspective of the South that has been cognitively shaped by the metropole, but rather from the point of view of the traditions of thought and culture in the South that remain relatively uncontaminated by that shaping. Curiously, Edward never asked that question himself. I want to now briefly pursue that question, at least to the extent that it's possible, in terms that are entirely earnest and without irony, resisting the pressures to think at the outset that there can be no perspective of the South on metropolitan ideas any longer that has not itself been formed by the metropole. If there's any such inevitable forming of it, even in what I, in this exercise, will try and do, I want that to be presented not ex ante, before the deliverances of the exercise, but at its end in assessing its intellectual outcomes. Those outcomes, though I will present them initially as what things look like from a distant perspective of once colonized lands, will turn out to have deep affinities with dissenting voices in the intellectual history of the metropole itself, voices which, however eloquent and powerful once, lost out in that intellectual history. If, as I suspect, the very fact that they lost out will give the impression that my efforts here are naive to those who are perpetually and alertly poised to find in every intellectual exercise of this kind the pitfalls of nostalgia, there's nothing to do but to acknowledge that that might be so and proceed. The project that many pursue, which seeks formulations of what has come to be called alternative modernities, would be silenced if one were to be inhibited from proceeding by such up-to-the-minute form of sneering about nostalgia. Of course, ignoring this sort of complacent sneering does not mean that in the project of seeking these alternative formulations, one ignores just how defective the traditions of the South may be, for example, in their feudal aspects, or how admirable certain dissenting voices in the West had been and are to this day. Even within the weight and preponderance of one's sense of critique of metropolitan privilege, it's an obligation of no small counterweight to be selective in what one repudiates from the frameworks of the North and what one invokes from within the perspective of the South. So long as the criteria by which one is selective is not arbitrary and is theoretically and politically well-motivated, there's no reason to be stopped by anxieties that the alternative formulations of modernity that they yield will seem to be out of step with what is immediately possible for one's time, defined as that is upon the modernity that we are landed with already. One might take comfort in the fact that creative efforts of the Renaissance were likely accused of something like a nostalgia for a classical period by some of the more complacent scholastic orthodoxies of the medieval period. What follows then braids what I have called the perspective of the South with the dissenting critiques in the intellectual history of the North along somewhat more expanded lines than the essay that has already been placed in your hands. A good place to begin, it would seem, would be to look from the perspective of the South at the most central political ideals that define the modern period of the North, the ideals of liberty and equality. How do these seem from such a conceptual distance? A distance at which those ideals have never really had a distinct centrality, at any rate, not in those explicit terms. The first thing that would come into view from a distant perspective of the South, I think, is a bizarre development. Virtually as soon as these ideals were first articulated in the North, they began to be elaborated in theoretical and methodological developments in such a way that they were chronically and acutely at odds with one another. Why, one would ask, if one was not oneself in the midst of the outlook, does an outlook describing itself with such self-congratulatory terms as the Enlightenment declare and rightly cherish two remarkable ideals and yet immediately come to understand them so they are in a sort of zero-sum tension with one another, such that increasing one seems always to be accompanied by the necessity to decrease the other? A distant observer would notice this peculiar phenomenon entrenched and everywhere in the philosophical and political arguments, with the rhetoric of Cold War disputation as only a very late and very crude manifestation of the tension that has existed between these two ideals for well over 2.5 centuries. So I repeat, why should a tradition of political thought theoretically frame its two chief ideals in such a way that they are pitted against each other? That is a question which can't possibly get an answer that leaves out the much larger context of the sort of political economy that had developed in Europe and the effect it had on political thinking in and since the Enlightenment. I cannot pursue that context and its effect in a brief lecture, whose main theme lies elsewhere. I cannot, in fact, do much more than mention two features of the political theorizing that produced this tension between its two ideals, and convey how, given the deep roots that these features have taken in our sensibility and our practice, we have come to see it as virtually impossible to question these features without seeming to be pursuing quite unintuitive or outdated lines of thought. One feature is too well known and well mined to bear much more than the most minimal mention, and that is the linking of the notion of property to a notion of the personal liberty which its ownership bestows on one, a liberty that is carried in a right and therefore enshrined in the law of the land. How the possession of private property, when seen in these terms of liberty, undermines equality in the economic sphere, and therefore in other spheres, has been the subject of extensive commentary, and Marx was, of course, only its most famous and powerful critic. Less explicitly theorized is another feature which I will call the incentivization of talent. It seems to us the most natural thing in the world to think that someone's talent should be acknowledged as hers, and that it is she who should be praised and rewarded for it. We think it a failure to respect someone's individuality to fail to do so. Take any example of a poem or a scientific discovery or a fine test century. We praise individuals for such things and other such products of individual talent and expect them to be rewarded, whether it's a poet or a scientist or a batsman. We don't admire the zeitgeist for such productions. We admire the particular individuals, and we think the rewards they get for it are deserved. Notions such as desert, thus, also get linked to one among other rights possessed by individuals. This goes so deep in our thinking that it's likely to be considered an hysterical, egalitarian ideologue's artifice to deny it. Denying it seems to fly in the face of our intuitive understanding of what it is to be an individual, rather than just a symptom of the zeitgeist in embodied human form. It violates what we conceive to be the liberty of an individual to reap the rewards of the exercise and efforts of his or her talents, not to mention the liberties of others to enjoy the productions of these efforts at their most excellent, because they're incentivized in these ways to be as excellent as they can be. But like the liberty attaching to possession of property, this way of thinking of liberty as attaching to talent also promotes social and economic inequality. Just think of the most ordinary things: endorsement for sportsmen or women, bonuses for Wall Street sharks. You recall when there was an outcry about such bonuses, Wall Street response was, well, you're going to remove the talent from our financial industry if you cut down on the bonuses. To which the obvious response was, well, if the talent got us into this mess, let's have some mediocrity. But that's the idea. And just ordinary merit bonuses in the workplace and so on, these are standard ways of generating inequalities. This feature is less structurally central to our culture than the liberty that's tied to property. That's structurally central. But it perhaps goes even deeper psychologically. And the dichotomy it generates with equality is therefore more subtly troubling. And it seems just as impossible to overcome. I mention these two sources of the tension only to give a completely familiar sense of how far such thinking has gone into our sensibility, how entrenched it is in the very way we deploy these terms, and how, therefore, it would seem almost to change the semantics of the term, of the terms, if we were to think that the tension would be removed or resolved. That is to say, if we managed, per impossibile, to see them as not being in tension, it would not be because, as Thomas Kuhn might have put it, it would only be because, as Thomas Kuhn might have put it, we have changed the meanings of the terms, liberty and equality, not because we've produced an improved theory of politics within the framework of the Enlightenment. Within that framework, things are, on this score, unimprovable. In other words, what I mean by framework here is perhaps one of the diverse things that Kuhn meant by his term paradigm. And if so, clearly we need to shift to another framework if we are ever going to remove the tension between these two notions. In such a new framework, neither liberty nor equality would mean what they meant in the framework of the Enlightenment thought. No more than mass in Einstein's physics meant what it meant in Newtonian mechanics, if Kuhn is right. How might such a shift in framework be sought? To do so brutally, by brutally redefining the terms or announcing a new term, Balibar's neologism, equiliberty, for instance, might come off more as a valiant act of semantic stipulation. But the worry is that it may be an act in vain. This sort of willful dictation of nomenclature seldom works except perhaps in purely classificatory exercises, which don't pretend to theory. To say, from now on, I will use the word X as follows, with a view to presenting an alternative theory, is to place the cart ahead of the horse. Discourse about human concerns should be posterior to, a natural outgrowth of a prior conceptual understanding. It can't by itself declare new forms of understanding into existence. What makes language so central to our human concerns is not that it can itself dictate how we think, but that it's the repository of how we think and how we have thought. So new frameworks for thought must be constructed first, and this may then have the effect of revising the meanings of terms by situating them in a new conceptual framework. In keeping with that suggestion, here is how I've allowed myself to think of it. There's no improving our understanding of these notions of liberty and equality as they stand, so as to resolve the tension between them. So, let's, as a start, usher them off stage entirely. If this is to disinherit the entire tradition of liberal thought of the Enlightenment, so be it. Once these are exhumed, we need to replace them on center stage with a third, more primitive concept. That is to say, a concept more fundamental to our social and political life than even liberty and equality. This is all a perspective from the South, by the way, so I'm really like Robert Graves with Claudius. I'm speaking from the South. Okay. Once these are exhumed, we need to replace them on center stage with a third, more primitive concept. That is to say, a concept more fundamental to our social and political life than even liberty and equality. And this is to be done with the idea that liberty and equality may subsequently be introduced once again by the back door, as it were, but now merely as necessary conditions for the achievement of this more basic ideal that occupies the central position. So reintroduced, there's reason to hope that these terms may have undergone substantial revision in their meaning, and thus may no longer express concepts that are at odds with one another. Okay. So that's the paradigm shift thought here. So we need then to fasten on an appropriately more fundamental concept. To be more fundamental than concepts such as liberty and equality, which have been so central to our theoretical understanding of politics, it would have to track something not necessarily older and more traditional in our political understanding, so much as something that speaks more immediately to our experience and our ordinary lives. And here, if we continue to keep firmly in mind that we are engaged in an exercise finding a view from the South that has not been wholly dominated by the metropolitan frameworks, the folk and spiritual and popular traditions of the South outside the orbits of that framework, the concept and ideal that is most naturally on offer is the concept of an unalienated life. And I think that the perspective of several traditions of the South, from which it might seem as if the ideal of an unalienated life could be extracted as the most fundamental goal of politics, would find deep affinities in the long tradition of dissent in the North. Dissent from its own orthodox and dominant framework, starting with early prescient radical sects of the English Revolution, well before the Enlightenment, and a whole range of subsequent scientific dissenters against the willful exploitation of science for profitable gain, through some canonical romantics, Ruskin, Morris, Thoreau, later, the so-called early Marx, so-called, that's a canard of Althusser's, all the way down to Heidegger and to Horkheimer and Adorno. I won't spell out the affinities between them and the Southern perspective, but instead let me just try and put an analytical framework on what the sources of alienation appear to be from this perspective, with a view to approaching some broad conclusion about the notion of an unalienated life would then be seeking to address. From the popular rather than the elite and imitative traditions of the South, it would seem that something like the following very general question, might be initially fruitful in expressing the South's puzzlement about what they see from such a distance. That question is, how and when, the South might ask, did it come to pass in a whole dominant part of the globe that the world came to be seen not merely as a place to live in, but a place to master and control? It's a genealogical question, how and when. This question gives a very primitive and premonitional sense of the sources of alienation. But posed just in these terms, it is so omnibus that it's hard to know how to go about addressing it. At this level of generality, perhaps all one can do is to see what sort of issue is being raised in raising the question. Thus consider a development in high philosophy from within which the genealogical dimension of the question's point comes into focus. The South's more philosophical observers would notice, for instance, that in the North, philosophers have for some 2000 years recurringly raised in epistemology skeptical questions about our knowledge of the external world. But sometime in the 17th century, primarily in the hands of Descartes, a new conclusion was drawn. If one can doubt our knowledge of the external world, quite possibly the external world does not exist. No skeptic in the tradition ever drew this conclusion till Descartes. The ancients who formulated skeptical doctrines never concluded that the world may not exist from their assertion that there was no knowledge of it. Why not? Because they did not assume that the only way to relate to the world was via knowledge. They took it for granted that if one were to doubt the possibilities of knowledge, that would do nothing wholesale to undermine the more ordinary relation we bear to it of merely living in it. It was Descartes' innovation, one that expressed a transformation in his time, whose legacy is that of an increasing detachment of outlook towards the world we live in, elevating the idea of living in it itself into some highly cognitively mediated relation that underlies the mastery and control we're trying to genealogically diagnose. But much more breakdown of this question is needed if we are to go beyond this generality to some more detailed analysis. Bringing in broader observational perspectives from the South than purely philosophical ones, four further breakdown questions might help to make more vivid the sources of this alienation. So four questions. They all have the same template. They are, one, how and when did they transform the concept, how and when did the North transform the concept of nature into the concept of natural resources? Second, how and when did they transform the concept of human beings into the concept of citizens? Third, how and when did they transform the concept of people into the concept of populations? And fourth, how and when did they transform the concept of knowledges to live by into the concept of expertise to rule by? And the reason why each of these questions, which you will recognize as echoing at a more specific and tractable register, the more general question. And so each of these four questions hints at an underlying source of alienation in that each of them tries to genealogically uncover an increasing detachment or disengagement in the way one approaches its chief subject, whether it be nature or humanity or knowledge. So in a brief lecture, I'm going to speak only, and that too very briefly, to the first two of these four questions before concluding with some very rudimentary remarks about what an ideal of an unalienated life that seeks to overcome these two sources of alienation might, in its most crude and sloganized form, look like from the traditional perspective of the South. Within the outlooks of that traditional perspective, nature was not equated with natural resources almost always because the traditions of the South took nature to be sacralized. A built-in constraint against seeing it as a mere resource, even if one lived on and by it. And this is just how much of popular Christianity conceived of nature in the early modern period in Europe. Sometimes this was described as a modified Neoplatonism in popular Christianity by intellectual historians. So, for instance, the radical Puritan sect, the Diggers, among several others in England, resisted the system of enclosures because it was transforming something sacred, something to live in, to make a life in, and to respect, into a resource and a site for an early form of agribusiness. Not the new science itself, but the outlook that was emerging around the new science of that period was precisely keen to undermine these sacralized conceptions so as to remove all conceptual obstacles to predatory commercial extraction from nature. And the mandarins of the Royal Society in England, I mean, these were real mandarins. It's sort of amazing to look at the documents of the Royal Society. The mandarins of the Royal Society in England and its counterparts somewhat later in the Netherlands and the rest of Europe were aligning themselves with commercial interests and with high Christianity. In England, this was just Anglican Orthodoxy, latitudinarian segment of the church, which opposed Neoplatonism of the popular Christianity of the radical sects and described it as enthusiasm. These are the developments that, if one were to see them as alien to the perspective of the South, one would think that perception anticipated pervasively among the scientific dissenters of the late 17th century. I'm thinking of John Toland, for instance, or Anthony Collins. And early 18th century in Europe who fought against such a desacralization of nature. These dissenters appealed to the Neoplatonism of the earlier radical sects, political sects, as a form of resistance to the emerging outlook wrought by the new science that was, with the alliances it had formed with commercial interests, transforming the local egalitarian collective agrarian life, the transformation of merely living in nature to its mastery and control for large-scale profit and gain. And these agricultural surpluses, which came from this change, would in turn feed into the creation of large metropoles. If you have a surplus in the countryside, you have nowhere to spend it, you create cities, destroying the life of agrarian communities. Much of this was consolidated in the systematic political thought of the North. Much of this process I've just briefly described was consolidated in the systematic political thought of the North by a widely influential methodological development that posited a conjectural past in which contracts, social contracts, were said to have been generators of norms and principles to live by. Thus, for instance, in one dominant familiar strand of this contractarian tradition, going from John Locke to Robert Nozick, there are other strands which are not relevant to this. In this one strand, we are told, this is from Locke to Nozick, suppose that we start in the state of nature, and suppose that there are as yet no policies or laws to live by, and suppose that there are as yet, there are no laws and policies to live by, nor is there any sort of institution of property. Then suppose that some of us join and come up with an agreement with which we resolve to keep faith, an agreement about rules for the private appropriation of property out of the common. We agree that if someone comes upon a stretch of ground, fences it, and registers it with a primitive form of bureau that we also set up, then it becomes his or hers, well, his. And here's the punchline. We then say to ourselves that this may be only done if, by doing so, no other is made worse off than they hitherto were. And we elaborate this crucial proviso by saying in particular that if one were to hire others at wages which enable them to live better, they would in fact be better off than they were in the state of nature. This is just the core of the social contract from Locke to Nozick in that strand. The underlying claim of these theoretical posits of a contract in all versions and strands of it is to show one thing. How come we are, as a result of the contract, better off than we were in a state of nature? In the strand that I'm focusing on, in particular, the assessment of political principles by such a conjunction of mutual advantage in aggregative ameliorative conditions, both for possessors of land and those who worked on it, became the cornerstone of the economic outlook of liberalism, even through a later period of industrialization when industrial capital rather than land was at stake. In its historical context, what this contractarian notion consolidates and justifies in the historical context, what it justified is a system of enclosures, which though it had begun fitfully a century or more earlier, had set in deeply and systematically and by right in a society only in Locke's time and led to the thoroughly predatory commercial attitudes towards nature and its bounty that I mentioned, as well as to a very specific conception of governance and law to support them. The Lockean social contract as a bit of political theory construction both explains these developments, historical developments, while in a carefully constructed normative facade presents them as moral and political achievements. So it explains them and presents them as normative and political achievements. The entire doctrinal outcome of such contractual theorizing, appealing to a conjectural past, is thus presented as having both an historical inevitability and a rational justification, with an appeal, therefore, on two quite different registers, the descriptive and the normative. The historical embedding of a social contract theory is more fully revealed if we take a look at some of its arguments and assumptions via criticisms implicitly found in the range of dissenters and enthusiasts I've mentioned. Let's return to the punchline of the familiar contractarian scenario. This is what I said in the exposition, in the punchline. We agree that if someone comes upon a stretch of ground, fences it, and enters it into a register at a primitive form of bureau that we also set up, then it becomes his or hers, the punchline is, we then say to ourselves that this may only be done if by doing so, no others made worse off than they hitherto were. And we elaborate that proviso by saying, in particular, that if one were to hire others at wages which enable them to live better, they would in fact be better off than they were in the state of nature. Now, the radical critique of this imagined scenario would then go something like this. Such a contractual outcome, it would say, as is expounded here, has what might be called, what economists call, an opportunity cost. What is that? An avoided benefit when you make a choice is counted as an opportunity cost of your having made that choice. This idea applies straightforwardly to our case, so says the radical dissenting. What the radical critique says is, because the land is thus privatized, we cannot set up a system for working the land in common and as a commons. Thus, even though we agree that we are all better off than we were in the state of nature, it is still perfectly possible for us to say that we are worse off than we would have been had the private economy not been established. This is a simple and obvious enough counterfactual claim, but it has a very significant and less than obvious theoretical result. It philosophically transforms the very notion of consent to something that is not even so much as recognizable from within the contractualist tradition. Consent, once this counterfactual is in place, should be viewed instead as a more complicated act than might otherwise seem in that tradition. It should be viewed as follows. Whether someone can be said to have consented is not necessarily to be viewed as the contractualist tradition proposes, but rather it may be a matter of what he or she would choose in situations that don't in fact obtain. In which case, the entire Lochtenosic tradition of thought may be assuming or inferring that we have implicitly, rationally consented to something which we in fact have not. Such a revisionary understanding of the notion of consent can be understood as offering a counterfactual maneuver in order to improve upon the normative ideal that this tradition of contractualism offers, or if you find that a tendentious way of putting things, then at the very least to offer an alternative normative ideal. But really, the point I'm insisting on is that this entire line of criticism is in any case not just an idle theoretical counterfactual exercise at improving the normative ideal, because history gives considerable support to the counterfactual by recording a tremendously active and vocal dissenting tradition in the early modern period against the incipient liberal ideas about the economy and polity. Some of these dissenters, the early ones, were not targeting Locke since they've predated Locke. I include them even so because the counterfactual I've presented should not be thought of as an argument from anachronism. It is counter to fact, as counterfactuals are, but the point is that it's not counter to all facts. It is counter only to facts which came to be because others very much in the air did not survive for reasons that need not by any means be described as having the force of rational necessity about them. Their failure to survive, far from being determined by rational force, was a matter of the success of particular worldly alliances that I mentioned earlier, which were formed consciously or unconsciously at a particular period of time, and which managed to silence a lively and systematic resistance to them, but quite different dissenting ideas, a silencing that owed nothing to rational superiority, but rather to the greater force of worldly organization of elite interests on the victorious side. The dissenters, such as Winston Lee and Walwin, to name just two, gave serious elaboration of the ideas contained in the counterfactual I've proposed, ideas about precisely what might be possible for the economy and polity if one did work the land in common, and indeed not just theoretical elaboration, but in the case of the sect known as the Diggers, even implementation in local experiments, thereby raising at least briefly for a period in of a dozen years or so in mid-17th century England, the possibility of preempting the entire trajectory of doctrines that Locke's theoretical construct of the social contract was intended to generate. If I'm right then, this counterfactual with its own historical instances detectable in the dissenting traditions of the time, shows that the normative ideal found in the very idea of a social contract, in this strand of it, are not merely consolidating of the orthodox liberal doctrines that eventually won out, but it shows also first that the doctrines are presented via the social contract as having a historical necessity and inevitability, which, if the dissenting critique was right, they do not possess. And second, presented via the social contract's aspiration to a normative ideal as possessing the right of a rational force and conviction that they need never be granted as possessing. I'm keen to put on record an entire historical dissenting tradition. You know, from the South, these people look very vivid. They've now been written out of history. You know, Christopher Hill and a few others wrote it. As soon as Christopher Hill wrote it, there was a barrage of opposition saying, the renters don't even exist, said the revisionary historians of the 17th century. And this was, you know, a real ideological fight. I'm keen to put on record an entire historical dissenting tradition in the early modern North so as to see how clearly, closely they are echoed in struggles in the contemporary South. Consider the following report from the Calcutta, now pronounced Kolkata, Telegraph, of what Mr. P. Chidambaram, who was then the Home Minister, from his perch in the Indian cabinet had declared. Here's what this guy said. This is a report from the Kolkata Telegraph. Union Home Minister Chidambaram today called for a rejection of the counterculture against the use of natural wealth, pitching the development debate as a choice between museums and modern societies at a time several mining and power projects are held up because of protests. Quote, quoting the minister, I don't think we should allow the counterculture to grow. A counterculture which says that people in these areas should live as they lived 300 or 400 years ago. We are not building museums here. We're building a modern society, a modern state. He told this to the inaugural session of the Northeast Business Summit. The purpose is clear. These people who protest that the natural environment and the people who live in it and are sustained by it in the modest ways that allow it to be sustained was not a mere resource for development, had no future in what India is to become. An entire point of view and the people who propagate it are thus made inconsequential, a people without any place in a blueprint for the future as drawn up by the expert as a business summit, a people reduced to not mattering for where the North had gone and India was to go. This is the ultimate form of detachment, to remove a people by the stroke of an ideological declaration. You see, you can kill people in increasingly detached ways. There was a time when if I had to kill you, I would have to face you with a spear and put the spear in you. You can now go 5 miles up in the air and bomb the hell out of a city, and it's just a statistic in the next morning's newspaper. But here's something that takes, then there are drones and so on. But here's something that is even more detached and remarkable. One would think ad absurdum, if it wasn't intended so seriously, is to remove the people by the stroke of an ideological declaration from a position of corporate and governmental power, I think a form of rarefied cognitive rather than bodily genocide in the name of the forward march, perhaps the end of history. One might think this is just to cite a minister with a mission of development. But why attribute this outlook to an accumulating, much wider sensibility, as I've been doing, rather than merely to the state that promotes such development on the part of the corporations it serves? Why do I think it's got a much wider? There's plenty of evidence of the outlook's widespread elite subscription. Even one of the most humane contemporary economists, one who I admire greatly, Amartya Sen, has written against those who protested the disposition of agricultural land for corporate development projects in India, from those who worked on it. And he said the following. England went through its pain. This is Amartya Sen. England went through its pain to create its Manchesters and Londons, and India will also have to do so. This is probably the most humane economist writing today. I mean, of the mainstream economists, right? Nobel Prize, Harvard University. Such a claim, which appeals to an historical analogy, is astonishing for omitting the entire historical context about which it speaks, one which reveals Sen's analogy to be grossly imperfect. Those who were dispossessed from their land and way of life by the primitive accumulation, that's Marx's word, by the primitive accumulation of an earlier period in England, moved in great numbers across the Atlantic to America. There is no place for the dispossessed of, say, rural Bengal to go, except to the already glutted cities and their slums, creating heightened forms of urban immiseration. When the mobility of labor had some sort of parity with the mobility of capital, remarks such as Sen's may have had a point. When there's complete disparity between them, with immigration laws on the one side constraining labor's mobility and the remantling of the Bretton Woods institutions on the other side, releasing capital for far greater mobility than it ever had, Sen's remark comes off as being not very different from Chidambaram's remarks. And that shows how entrenched the attitude is in the intelligentsia. So far, in charting early sources of alienation, I've stressed the transformation of the concept of nature and its effects on generating ruthless, dispossessing forms of political economy, extractive political economy. On the question of transformation of human beings into citizens, the issues are ripe for misunderstanding, given what seem to be honorable commitments to many Enlightenment ideals. But let me present some aspects of these commitments as they might appear from a perspective from the South, as it views their genealogy. From this distance, it would seem that Europe in the late 17th century, as a result of some of the changes already mentioned, had come to find outdated in earlier forms of legitimation of the state, which had appealed to the divine rights of the monarch who occupied it. It therefore had to seek new forms of justification for the state and the power it exercises. And since the Westphalian Peace, it sought this justification by a quite different strategy, by looking to modern social psychology rather than a God-given right of the tenant of an exalted office. The strategy was complex. The state was now to be seen as one half of an undecouplable conjunction with a new form of entity. This entity that came to be called the nation could not sufficiently be defined in purely territorial terms and borders. If it was conceived merely territorially, it could only justify the state in terms of the power it needs to protect it from other such entities. But that would not justify the state's power and authority over its own population. A further element was needed then, a commitment drawn from the populace. Contractualist accounts were presumably relevant to this commitment too, because you agreed to a contract, the populace agreed to a contract. But that was high theory. A yet further and far more crucial element would have to be less fictional and less hypothetical, more grounded in actual political psychology that had to be generated in this emerging citizenry. The populace had to be made to develop a feeling for this new kind of entity, the nation, because this entity, the nation, for which you were supposed to generate a feeling, was understood as being inseparable from the state, the nation dash state. Right? The feeling for the first half of this hyphenated conjunction, the nation, would confer a justification upon the second half, the state, which had no longer any independent significance except as part of the conjunction with the first. and which, because of its conjunction with this abstracted, what Ben Anderson calls imagined, entity, took an increasingly centralized form, unlike early forms of power, which were relatively scattered. In due course, this psychology of feeling would come to be called nationalism, understood in terms that were at odds with the traditional perspective of the South that I'm stressing, which often sought to define nationalism as exhaustively and only synonymous with anti-imperialism and emptied of these historical European connotations. These points are so familiar that they might seem innocuous even when viewed from the South, until something equally familiar comes into view when one asks, how did post-Westphalian Europe go about generating this legitimating political feeling or psychology? How did it instill this in the population in Europe? All over that continent, it was done by a method whose notoriety only came to be fully understood by Europeans in the middle of the last century as a result of developments in Germany in the 1930s and 40s, but which, if viewed from a sufficient distance, as the South offers, will be seen to have much deeper historical roots. This was the method of finding an external enemy within the territory and the population and despising it as the other and subjugating them, the Jews, the Irish, Protestants in Catholic countries, Catholics in Protestant countries, and thereby instigating a feeling among the rest of the population of a sense of privileged possession of this new entity, the nation, as ours. So you find an external enemy within, despise and subjugate it, have a rest of the populace feels the nation is ours. Later, when numerical forms of discourse emerged and statistical methods in the social sciences were applied, categories such as majority and minority would be deployed to describe this, and such a method of generating a feeling for the nation and thereby legitimizing state power would come to be called majoritarianism. From the perspective of some parts of the South, one could only hope that this entire trajectory by which Europe came to be what it is, an assembly of nation states, should not be imitated even as it fell into nation statehood after decolonization. This was how citizenship began in the North. And it is to repair the ravages wrought by this method that the North had to adopt various civic measures and ideologies, such as secularism, a political doctrine, something distinct from the large social cultural process of secularization, and later, actually because of quite different issues having to do with immigration and so on, policies such as multiculturalism. Where and only where such damage had not already occurred and become entrenched in the South, rather than adopt secularism in an act of pointless mimicry, it would be better instead to disallow the damage to occur among its people in the first place. That's how I think, from the traditional perspective of the South, it would seem. There's no reason to adopt secularism. We didn't have the problem which was intended to repair in the first place. Citizenship, as it came to be consolidated in notions of rights and in constitutional codes, for all that is rightly celebrated as worthy in them, as much in favor of rights as the next person, had other genealogical aspects that one might only notice if one had a distant enough perspective, as I'm trying to seek from the South. This genealogy goes back to notions of civility that emerged in the same period in which I've been locating the fault line. There has been fine and detailed study of the rise of notions of civility in the work of such intellectual historians as Norbert Elias, and more recently Keith Thomas and Peter Burke. In some of their descriptions, one can gather a certain semantics that was essential to how the notion was characterized in this period. Semantics. Civility, which consisted in a range of things from comportment to dress and speech, was said to be a property of the lifestyles of the monarch and his courts, who were often said to rule over a brute populace by analogy with, indeed a mundane version of, a distant and removed and exiled Newtonian god, Clockwinder, controlling a now desacralized and brute and material and inert universe. Newton actually called it stupid in the Optics. And so correspondingly, in the semantic stipulation, civility was contrasted, I mean, this is the meaning of civility. This contrast is built into the meaning of civility. So correspondingly, in the semantic stipulation, civility was contrasted with cruelty, which was the property of the lifestyles and behaviors of the rude populace. When I call this semantics, I mean to suggest that this distribution of locations for civility and cruelty, respectively, had nothing to do with the empirical concerns of evidence and observation. These were stipulations of how these words were to be used and internalized, independent of the facts of behavior at either location. So civility was the property of the lifestyle and behavior, the property classes and the courts and the monarchs, cruelty of the rude population. By the way, the sentimental left buys into this distinction in a way because of a sort of, you know, the often wistful attribution of a kind of collective jouissance to the working classes. I think it just buys into this distinction. The effect of this usage of the semantics has had a remarkable and I think a deeply imbibed self-deception, a fact that the intellectual historians I mentioned do not register, though they are central to how the culture of liberal democracy would appear to a perspective from the South. The self-deceptive effect of the semantics about civility was to create a screen that hid from the European monarchs and their courts and the property classes the cruelty of their own perpetration on the brute populace, who alone were counted by the semantics as capable of cruelty. And from the southern view, in the modern West or North, this screen of self-deception morphed over from the notion of civility into the more abstract domain of rights and constitutions and codes, whereby cruelty came to be understood by nations who possess such rights and constitutions as only occurring in nations that do not possess them. Thus, the cruelty perpetrated by the former on the distant lands of the latter were hid from the perpetrators because cruelty can only really happen in lands without rights and constitutions. An attitude quite prevalent to this day, when it's still pervasively assumed that cruelty can only really happen, say, in Mugabe's Zimbabwe or Saddam's Iraq, but not in the metropolitan West. There is no way to understand the phenomenon of Guantanamo without the self-deceptive function that rights have come to have. No matter how rightly celebrated rights are for the great good that they have done where they've been adopted. Torture of that sort cannot be located on American soil because we don't do torture, since cruelty only happens in those sorts of places. If the South and some of its traditions showed a studied indifference to rights and constitutions and the very idea of citizenship, it should not be because it repudiates the good that these may bring about, but because it is able to see these other aspects of it as emerging from these links with expert knowledges of codified rule, whose self-deceptions had a genealogy in an earlier period of elite lifestyles and aspirations to civility. Now, turning to this observed in genealogical sources of alienation in the North, how might the promise of a shift in framework that I've proposed at the outset be sought, even in the broadest outline? I'm now just going to really present slogans. Let's observe first that in the southern genealogy of the sources of alienation in the North, the fourth line of the increasing detachment of outlook that sets us on its path is the desacralization of our conception of nature. And even if we cannot, in the historical present of the North, easily conceive of a return to sacralize nature to overcome the source of alienation, we nevertheless have a more secular counterpart, secular conceptual repertoire, by which to think of what it might be to re-enchant the world, including nature. for it's arguable, I think, that the more general, the deeper and more underlying fault line is not desacralization, but the evacuation of value properties from the world, including nature. That the divine should have once widely been believed to be the ultimate source of value in nature does not require us to conceive of value today as having no other source than the divine. Indeed, I think the concept of value is sui generis. It isn't. You can't dig deeper and think that value is explained by something else. It's just self-standing. Indeed, there is no reason to think that value can't be simply self-standing, that it has no source at all, whether divine or any other. To think otherwise is to invite a stunning fallacy to which developments in the early modern North that I've been genealogical tracing fell prey. If value cannot any longer be said to have a divine source, this is the North speaking, it must be that nature has no value properties. Since once desacralized, the only way to characterize nature is as containing only those properties which the natural sciences study. In other words, since the natural sciences don't study the sacred, and since they don't study value either, nature must be evacuated of value as well as God. You can't concede that there's a God delusion in our understanding of nature without also conceding that there's a value delusion. It is this characterization of nature as that which the natural sciences study, which is the genealogical starting point of the detachment of outlook that my four questions, really five if you count the general one, have identified as pervasive. And as a characterization of nature, nature is what the natural sciences study, as a characterization of nature, I believe it is nothing less than a superstition of modernity. By superstition, I mean a belief so accepted in the wider belief community that we take it on trust and forget when or how it was proved and why and in what ways it helps us to live better. Among the dominant intellectual classes, it is a dogma that has been maintained by sheer intellectual browbeating, dismissing all denials of it as an expression of an unscientific mentality. But there's nothing unscientific whatever about denying it. One can only be unscientific if one denies or contradicts some proposition in some science. And no science contains the proposition that the natural sciences have full and exhaustive coverage of nature. That's something philosophers say, and the wider sensibility, the wider intelligentsia who's been just basically cognitively dominated by this ideology, says. And as Wittgenstein said, the idea is so uncompulsory that only a philosopher would have thought of it. To declare this to be a superstition is not to express any phobia against science itself. I have no phobia against science. It is rather to protest and resist an outlook promoted by the mandarins around science by alliances that formed with commercial and orthodox interests in the modern period of the North, an outlook whose detachment the four questions try to convey and whose alienating social and political effects we've tried to diagnose. So if I'm just going to give you the slogan now at the end of this analysis. What do I mean by an unalienated life vis-a-vis nature? Here's the slogan then. It just falls out of what I've been saying. To be unalienated in one's relations to nature is just to be in normative sync, for our agency to be in sync with the normative demands that are made on us by the value properties in nature. That's what it is to be unalienated in our relations to nature. So that's my slogan. We can talk about it, what its implications are, and what it means in detail. I'm going to now ask, what is it to be unalienated, not from nature, but a more social form of unalienatedness, which comes from these detachments, which are not just vis-a-vis nature, but populations and citizens. Is there a corresponding slogan for what it is to overcome the more social forms of alienation? Now, from the folk and popular spiritual traditions of the South that I've kept implicitly in mind as I've been saying all this, a matching sloganized ideal might be extracted as simply, this is just breathtakingly simple, and much in need of elaboration, but I'm going to just give it to you in its most it should take your breath away, but here's an interesting question I have, which is, given how simple this thought is, I don't know if anybody has actually said it in the North. I don't know if any philosopher has said it. Anyway, here's the thought. What we aspire to, here's the slogan, what we aspire to when we seek a socially unalienated life is the realization of the ideal that nobody in a society or group is well off if someone is badly off. That's it. As I said, such a thought is embedded in diverse popular understandings of social and communal life in the South. Let me conclude this paper with a sort of preliminary and promissory discussion of some of the complexity behind this deceptively simple thought. First, by considering an objection to it that might come naturally to mind. It might be tempting to say about the slogan, this just is the idea of equality. So why have you been going on about, at the outset, that you would be constructing a framework in which equality would not be on center stage, but a necessary condition for something else, which you call the unalienated life? You just, when it comes down to it, you've just articulated equality. This response misses what the slogan is seeking to convey. What it misses is that the entire point of the slogan was to assert the importance of equality only at second remove. In a situation where some are well off and others are not, the idea of the slogan is not merely to say that this is a bad thing, as an assertion of the importance of equality that is not once removed would say, but rather to say that even those who in a situation of inequality are well off are not in fact so. That's the point of the slogan. That distinction makes all the difference. Given that someone is badly off, the sense in which therefore no one is well off is just what the social aspect of alienation amounts to. A form of malaise that affects all until necessary conditions of other ideals are met. It is a generalized unease of the mind, or as metaphysicians like to say, of being, which affects all social relations. In a society where some are not well off, all feel and partake of this alienation, even those who are well off. Often people don't know the cause or grounds of the malaise as having its roots in a society characterized by discrepancies in well-offness. Yet the malaise is manifest in a variety of different behaviors of theirs. Thus it is a subjective state of felt experience that can be said to have an objective presence in the minds of people whenever they live in societies with such deep discrepancies. Though I won't try and present it here, the empirical correlation between such discrepancies and the behavior that reflects this malaise is extremely well established. Of course, the behavior which reflects the malaise is bound to be very different in those who are well off than it is in those who are not. And it takes some careful psychological integration of theory and evidence to show how these are both symptoms of the same malaise of alienation. But that is not an insuperable difficulty. Lots to talk about, we can talk about. Okay, so let me just conclude with a few general integrating remarks to pull some strands of the discussion so far together. I can't possibly, as I said, spell these slogans out much beyond what I've done in this encapsulated form, but a rough sense of the dialectic within which any further spelling out would have to be pursued can be roughly conveyed. the unalienated life that came with the sense of belonging that was made possible by the social frameworks of a period prior to modernity was, as is well known and widely acknowledged, highly limited by the oppressive defects of those social frameworks. To say feudal to describe that oppression would be merely to use a vastly summarizing category that we've been brought up on. It is precisely those defects that the sloganized ideals of the Enlightenment, liberty and equality, were intended as directly addressing. And I've argued that since the methodological and theoretical framework within which those two concepts were then developed made it impossible to so much as conceive how liberty and equality could be jointly implemented, we should no longer see them as something to be directly approached, but rather as indirectly approached by the direct construction of something else, the idea of an unalienated life, thereby theoretically transforming the concepts of liberty and equality. Now, if the achievements of an ideal of an unalienated life were to bring in its wake, indirectly, conditions of liberty and equality, however transformed, it is bound to be very different from the unalienated life which is acknowledged to have existed in times prior to modernity, because the conditions in which it existed then were also acknowledged to be acutely lacking in precisely liberty and equality. So, given this historical and conceptual dialectic, what we need to show is how a new framework that breaks out of this dialectic would solve for three things at once: a transformed notion of liberty and equality, as I've said from the outset, but also, it would now seem, a transformed notion of the unalienated life from what it used to be. So this is to be conceived holistically as a triangular transformation. We overcome a certain historical and conceptual dialectic, and in doing so, together and at once, transform all three concepts that feature in it. It's a highly ambitious theoretical challenge to have emerged from our dialectic. How might we even begin to think of this triangular bootstrapping transformation of all three notions all at once? The complexity of the dialectic within which the ambitious task emerges suggests very general further questions to be asked and answered. We have to ask, first, what can be retained of the general idea of social belonging of an earlier time in any revision of the idea of an unalienated life for our own time? We know from the other elements of the dialectic that the social beginning of an earlier time, the social belonging of an earlier time, was marred by the defects of acute and chronic lack of liberty and equality. But we also know from the labors of this lecture's analysis that the attempts to directly overcome those defects were in turn marred by the fact that liberty and equality flowered in conception within a social framework in which deep forms of precisely alienation and non-belonging developed. And these in turn were of a piece with the theoretical and methodological developments that generated a highly individualized notion of liberty that attached to property and talent in ways that made for liberty's conceptual incoherence with equality. It would seem then that one place to begin, to first look for a concerted and triangulated transformation of all three notions, is to look for a more collective form of liberty. If liberty resides in self-governance, or the possession of the power to make the vital decisions that shape the material and spiritual aspects of our lives, collective liberty would consist, it would seem, in approaching these decisions in such a way that we make them not primarily with our own interests in mind, but the interests of everyone in society. These last few words, not with our own interests in mind, but with everyone's, express something that is so utterly familiar, it's a cliché, a piety. The critique of self-interest has been with us for a very long time. If there's going to be novelty in the pursuit of this, then it is only because it is to be essentially connected to the first half of that sentence, because it is far less well known and hardly at all theoretically developed that what such a critique of self-interest amounts to is the construction of a notion of liberty. That's the novel idea. That in making a fundamental criticism of self-interest, what you actually promote is liberty. That's not been a theoretically developed idea. Why has it been so little known and developed? Because self-governance, which is essential to how we conceive of liberty, has always been viewed in individualist terms. The world, both the natural and the social world, I had said, because of the value properties in it, make normative demands on us as individuals. That has been central through the entire long passage of this paper's argument. And to be unalienated, I've said, is for our agency to be in responsive sync with these demands. To see these demands from the world, capaciously conceived in both natural and social terms, for what they are, our own orientation to the world has to be something that goes beyond the orientation in which individual interests are primary. It's really a matter of phenomenology. I mean that entirely seriously. Look, let me give you a bodily analogy, and then you can extrapolate what the theoretical urge I have to the social. I was teaching my daughter to drive. So she's sitting next to me, I'm giving her the paces. Driving. I noticed something which I'd never noticed before. It's a pure phenomenological observation. Very bizarre that I should not have noticed it before. When I was driving, I realized my orientation, my bodily and physical orientation, was from the point of view of the car. My orientation on the physical space around me, on the road, was from the point of view of the car, not my bodily point of view. And I realized this only because when I turned to talk to my daughter, it suddenly became a completely different orientation from the point of view of my body. It's just one-on-one, right? That's what I have in mind. We've got to calibrate the individual with, and we've got to make this as a bodily analogy. We need a phenomenology of the social to get this thing that I'm talking about such novelty as there might be in this critique of self-interest as enhancing liberty. That orientation, when extrapolated to the social, even though it may involve the mentality of individuals, because it exercises liberty from the point of view of a more collective orientation of each individual to the world, i.e. the interests of all and of nature, it is bound to internally cohere with equality in its outcomes. Equality does not be seen as something extra. It is built into the deliverances of the exercise of liberty so conceived. I think I'll just stop. Thank you very much.